Welcome to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. We have a little side project here at Studio 2 called Studio 2 Extras. These are little interviews we do with newsmakers and artists and cultural figures that don't quite fit in the normal Studio 2 show, but we cut them as separate interviews and we put them in our podcast feed. Some of them we end up liking a lot. And so today, we're going to listen back to three recent Studio 2 extras that we really, really liked. One is my interview with a Gen Z musician in New Jersey who, get this, is writing a song about each of the state's 21 counties.
Yeah, and later in the hour, we'll play back my interview with National Book Award-winning author Imani Perry. In her novel from earlier this year, she weaves the color blue through Black history, culture, and spirituality.
But first, music we're hearing right now. That's The Roots. And you, Cherry, interviewed lead MC Tariq Black Thought Trotter about his recent memoir, The Upcycled Self.
Black Thought is often called one of the best MCs of all time. But his recent book goes further than the complex rhymes he's so well known for. He survived several traumas at a young age, including the murder of both of his parents and a devastating house fire. His memoir is this year's One Book, One Philadelphia free library selection. And in our conversation, he talked about tragedy, resilience, and the creative growth that ultimately made him a master at his craft.
It's my origin story. It speaks to the beginnings of the pieces of the puzzle that will become the man that I am. I cross paths with people who would say, hey, I've been supporting the Roots for such a long time, but, you know, I feel like I don't know anything about you after, you know, I've listened to 11,000 songs and I still, you know, the music isn't personal in that way. It was personal in terms of, you know, speaking for a culture and for the city of Philadelphia and for people like me and people who were from where I was from. But yeah, I never wore my personal story or that origin story on my sleeve.
The book starts at a very traumatic place. It starts with the fire at your home when you were 6 years old.
Yep.
You accidentally started a fire, burned down the family home. Why did you start with the fire?
You know, the fire for me, I mean, in my life, it just felt like a point of departure. It was, definitely not my earliest memory, but my earliest memory of, you know, sort of upheaval of the rug or the ground, for that matter, so having been pulled from beneath one's feet. There had been trauma in my life before that point. But yeah, at the time of the fire, I was 6 years old, and it was, you know, in retrospect, it was it's the earliest thing that I felt responsible for, that I was, you know, completely aware had affected so many other people, right? It was this thing that I had done that had changed, really, that would forever change, you know, my family dynamic and the lives of, you know, my older brother, my mother, and myself. You know, I had to revisit, I had to relive a lot of what I felt. I mean, what I've come to understand, I've been, pushing down and I've been repressing.
You know, we won't go into too deep into that story because I think people should
read the
book,
yeah.
Read it in your own words. But it's a profound moment in your life. And you write about your parents a lot in the book.
Yeah.
With so much love, but even while there was so much pain, your father was murdered when you were two, your mom when you were a teenager. But you write in such a way pointing out the fact that you were surrounded by so much love.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's about that sort of unconditional love shared between mother and son. And then an unconditional love for my father, who, you know, I didn't really know, but an unconditional love for the legacy that he still have been able to leave.
And your grandmother was there. You had aunties,
your
grandfather. And one of the things that I loved that you talked about was your love of fashion. And how it was genetic.
You're
a fashion head. You love your hats.
Yeah.
You love your frames. You got
Absolutely.
On a pair right now.
Absolutely.
And you said this was basically genetically ordained for you to be that kind of person.
Yeah. My grandfather had a haberdashery shop where men would come to have their hats cleaned or steamed, reblocked, you know, to have the shape put back into their brims. My father and his brothers, he had two brothers, they worked in that hat shop. So yeah, hats, just, you know, cool eyewear has always been just part of my family tradition. And my father was always big on, you know, wide brims and, you know, long coats, you know, always suited, you know, suits and ties at all times.
Yeah, you had your first pair of custom pants at like 10 years old.
I did, yeah. At the age of 10, it was actually for my 10th birthday party. I was having a pair of pants tailored, and I refused to arrive. I was like, you know, I can't show up until these slacks are done, and they had taken longer than expected. So by the time I got there, the party was pretty much over. But I mean, if you were there, then, you know, if you know, you know. When I pulled up, those slacks were slacking. I think it was some gabardines or something.
You was fly. You was fly at a party that you know, had cleared out, but you would look good on your 10th birthday.
Yeah.
I want to talk about your time at Kappa, because you went to the famous Philadelphia High School for Creative and Performing Arts for 2 years. You studied art, but you had this affinity for music.
Yeah, I'd always sort of excelled in the arts, and I'd always taken to visual art. You know, shout out to Jane Golden and the Philadelphia Mural Arts program, mm-hmm. of which I was a part of the very beginnings, when it was, you know, called the Philadelphia Anti-Graffiti Network. So at the age of 12, I was a young graph artist in the city who was also compelled to, you know, just express myself artistically in other ways and other mediums. Thankfully, I came up during a time that all these other outlets had been sort of built in to the infrastructure. There was, well, I mean, on the community, on the city, on the state level, there was, you know, all sorts of programs that I personally benefited from, right? I went to art camp at Fairmount Park in the summer. I went to, you know, extracurricular sort of art classes at community college on Saturdays. I went to Fleischer Art Memorial. All these schools that are, you know, really parts of programs that we have and had taken for granted for such a long time that we're now losing. And there were a few magnet schools of the arts and, you know, magnet schools for music that were in the city, you know, a couple of which were, you know, sort of close by. But at the time, Kappa was, you know, walkable from my crib. It was in my neighborhood.
And there were so many, like, people who went on to become nationally known who were at Kappa at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, you had Boyz II Men there. Yep. You had Emile LaRoe. You met Amir Thompson, a.k.a. Questlove, there. Yeah. What was it about the school? What was it about the time that you think was so rich,
I mean,
that,
you know,
so many people were able to come up?
Yeah, people talk about their, you know, having been something in the water. I think, you know, we were all products of sort of the 80s, you know, frustration, that, you know, angst, that, you know, some of those anxieties coming out of the Reagan era. All of that was fresh, and we were wanting to express ourselves and to respond to that. Mm-hmm. So, it was just dope for me as a visual artist to be immersed in the culture of, you know, Boyz II Men and Amel LaRue and Christian McBride and Joey DeFrancesco and Questlove, and where all these kids, Fatine Dantzler, all these artists were, you know, musicians that I would run into in the hallways and who I would hear their music coming out of the classroom. So it was just a beautiful time to be there.
And you met, you know, Amir there, and
yes.
You guys, what do you think it was that sort of solidified your bond? Because a lot of people become collaborators, but not decades later. People break up, they go their separate ways. What do you think has kept your relationship so strong for so long?
We initially bonded over our differences, and I think we were able to complete one another in many ways. Up until that point, I was able to sort of put him on to a life that he had yet to experience, and vice versa. And that included all this different music that I sort of grown up listening to and that I had taken to as a young person that he hadn't been exposed to yet.
He wasn't allowed to listen to some of the music you listened to.
Yeah, well, he wasn't allowed to listen to most of the music I listened to. And I, you know, didn't care I wasn't interested in listening to most of the music he listened to. We bonded sort of over that, over our differences in experience and our differences in musical taste. I mean, it's a marriage. And, you know, once if you lock in with somebody, you make a decision that you're not leaving, regardless to how it goes down, then it doesn't matter sort of what goes down, right? We're too dug in at this point. We've rocked together for over 30 years. I think we're sort of
in it for the long haul.
Yeah, to say the least.
That is a beautiful thing. I'd love for you to read a selection from your book on page 59.
Okay. Philadelphia is a city that is no one thing. It's more a place people wind up than a destination. And those accidental arrivals come together to create a layered intersection of histories, memories, and heritages. Learning to navigate its subtle lessons and boundaries is a rite of passage in and of itself. Even though Mount Airy held my roots, South Philly was my molding, for better and for worse. In West Philly, or North, stratification of the races could happen more easily. Less interaction needed to take place in blocks, less crowded, less blended. But off of the river, next to the ports, attracting both the crooks and hard hustlers and tireless workers alike, South Philadelphia was a Philly in its purest form. A paradoxical world full of dualities, one that I have always mirrored. One that I have always mirrored. One that I myself have always mirrored.
I love it. That's the master NC of you. You gotta well, say it just so.
This was very weird, like, to read. I've done quite a few talks, quite a few book talks, but the audio book is my voice. But I haven't really read the book out aloud, especially in front of folks. So
Different, right?
Yeah, definitely.
I love that passage just because I thought it said a lot. I was listening to some of your lyrics and, you know, and I read how your life had traumas, but you had these joys and you had these opportunities.
Yeah.
And you took, you know, you took whatever you had and you turned it into something beautiful.
Absolutely.
And to me, that is sort of an explanation of what Philadelphia is. How do you see yourself as a mirror of the city?
Really in those ways, you know what I mean? Philly is, I mean, like another character in this book, right? Philly has just as much of a role as any other people, in my life. And, you know, Philly is about resilience and about hustle and about grit. You know, however you apply yourself, you can come up from the mud. I think I learned that at a very young age. And, you know, I've always been able to, you know, to sort of to grind and make a thing happen. I used to sell shopping bags in the Italian market, like $50 shopping bags. I used to sell soft pretzels. You know, I mean, like, but however you got to get it how you live. I was a newspaper delivery dude. I did, you know, sort of all of the things.
You had your first job at 7. I was like, I thought I was doing good at like 10.
Yeah,
you were 7 years old with your first job.
First job, 7. It was like an eyeglass shop. So I had the discount on those frays as a kid. Yo, someone sent me a picture earlier of me at 13, like probably right before we formed the Roots, like ninth grade. I just started ninth grade. I look like, you know, like DMC from Run DMC.
How many frames do you think you have?
Well, now?
Yeah.
Oh, man, dozens. You know, you got indoor frames, you got outdoor frames, you know, the sunglasses that you're going to wear inside a studio are going to be different from what you need for the beach.
That's pretty cool. So I want to talk about being a master MC, because you're in rare air, right? You've been often named one of the greatest MCs of all time. I know you probably feel good about that, right?
I do. That's a huge compliment.
So, but what does it mean to you to be a great MC?
To me, I think in order to be a great MC, or to be a great anything for that matter, you have to begin with a certain base level knowledgeability of the history of what it is that you want to master. I mean, like, the real origin of something like, you know, hip hop or jazz or rock music or gospel or, you know, any of the stuff that is, you know, ultimately African in its origin, it's not safe to assume that we're even going to be able to prove that. You know what I mean? So I just feel like now more than ever, it's important for us as artists to, you know, to just lean into whatever it takes to maintain truth in the history of the arts in that way. But there's a whole technical aspect of it too. And that, you know, has to do with breath control and memory. And, you know, I consider myself as an artist to be, like, my style of storytelling to be more anthropological. So I think that's sort of, you know, my approach. And it's in that, it's a lot of information, it's dense. So the challenge has always been turning apples into applesauce. How can you make, you know, something that's so dense with information and so, you know, rich in that way, feel effortless and still be a bop, and still, for people who aren't really into dissecting lyrics and getting into something that is so super specific or heavy, how can you still appeal to, you know, that listener as well? So that becomes a challenge. And I think in the process of, you know, writing anything, I begin with something that is an apple, you know, is a lot more, you know, just complex. And my intention is for it not to lose anything, right? You know, applesauce has all of, you know, whatever you're going to get from an apple, but it's just more palatable, easier to digest, and has a more broad appeal. Yeah.
And we're getting close to wrapping up, but you said if you can win Philly, you can win anywhere. What makes Philadelphia such a tough crowd and such a confidence builder?
You know, Philly has always been, you know, take just no nonsense. I mean, whether you're just passing through or whether this is a place that you wind up, you know, once a Philadelphian, I feel like always a Philadelphian. Like once you've spent time as part of the Philly community, you could keep it moving and continue along in your journeys. But there's no place like Philly, man. And, you know, you have to have a thick skin, and you have to have a certain amount of, you know, resilience. You got to really have the wherewithal about yourself to make it here in this city. But it's possible. Like you move through the world after having lived in Philly, and you just experience it in a different way, and your hustle is just different.
You're a word nerd. So what is your favorite Philly word or phrase that you use all the time?
I mean, John.
Of course.
You know, I originated the spelling of John as J-A-W-N back in the day. Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
You like, give me my credit.
I mean, you know.
That was Tariq Trotter, a.k.a. Black Thought, founding member of The Roots and author of the Free Library's 2025 One Book, One Philadelphia selection. It's called The Upcycled Self, a memoir on the art of becoming who we are.
And coming up next on Studio 2, we're going to meet the Gen Z musician who is writing yacht rock odes to the Garden State. We'll be right back.
Here in Camden County, on the Delaware River, we've got the country.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. We first discovered musician Earth Keenan Salazar on Instagram, singing this song about Camden County in a smooth yacht rock style.
Cherry Hills are centered sharp eddy. Violence seized by Winslow's creed.
It was the first song and video of many he's planning to write, produce, and record for every single county in New Jersey.
That's 21.
21. The other thing is, he calls his style brain rot. A lot of his lyrics come from internet speak and endless meme scrolling. They don't make a whole lot of sense to me personally. But in our interview, I got him to explain it, and I think I understand. He also told me how this New Jersey project was conceived.
It started out as like a songwriting exercise, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in Philly, but Jersey, I've only been living there since like during the pandemic, so I don't really have as much knowledge of the state as I should, like being a resident of the state. So I kind of like took it upon myself to be like, you know what, let me see if I can do all 21 counties of New Jersey, like all a song for each one. The internet loves that sort of like quest, and wanting to follow along.
The idea that you're building towards something really appeals to an internet audience.
I think so. That's part of why I wanted to do it, because two birds, one stone, you know, social media content, also getting to stretch my songwriting chops a little bit.
I think we should rewind a little bit, because your chops are legit. You're born in the Philippines, right? Yep. Moved to the Philly area when you were really young.
Yes. Like Oxford Circle area is how I would describe like where I grew up. I come from like a musical household, but not in the sense that like my parents played music. They were 90s kids, right? So they loved, I heard Nirvana, Pearl Jam growing up in the house, and like my parents, like those were my parents' favorite bands, as well as a lot of like Filipino rock music. Just hearing that all the time. Mm-hmm. Some of my earliest memories are just like having a laptop, one of those old like Windows XP laptops, and just like opening up Windows Music Player, whatever it is, and just like listening through my parents' whole collection of like MP3s that they got off, you know, off their CDs or maybe LimeWire. I don't know.
Because,
yeah, exactly. Napster.
You don't know about all that. So your parents loved music, but they were not themselves musicians.
My dad played a little guitar.
A little bit.
He was doing some like high school, college band stuff way back in the Philippines, but yeah, he just showed me like your basic open chords, and he saw that I picked it up pretty quickly and just opened up like a YouTube tab for me and said, here, you know.
So you taught yourself through YouTube?
Pretty much at the beginning. Whoa. Yeah, I learned most of like what I know today at the beginning.
That is like a modern music education.
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
So fascinating.
I always tell people like my first degree was at YouTube University, right?
But then you ended up going to Berklee College of Music,
exactly.
Which is not YouTube University. It's a little older than that. So you went there to study what? I mean, first of all, you have to be very proficient just to get in.
Sure. What I gravitated toward was just doing every aspect of the music production process yourself and learning about how to do that all yourself. In this
becoming
major.
Like a one-man band.
Exactly,
in a sense.
Exactly. Wow. One-man band, one-man production team, one-man video team.
Which is interesting because that's perfect for, I would imagine, creating your own thing on the internet. If
Absolutely.
You can make something sort of soup to nuts and package it and put it on the internet yourself, you have now become the musician, the producer, and the label.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, and that's what you've done. You've created your own internet brand. I mean, you have a large following at this point.
Yeah, it's such a pleasure and privilege to be able to do something like that in the 21st century. I mean, like, you have really no barrier these days to just start doing it. Yeah. You know what I mean?
There's no barrier between you and the audience. Really.
Yeah.
The audience is waiting for you. And as long as you've got the chops, which you do, bam, you could find your audience.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, engage with them and have a conversation in the comments. Some people didn't, you know, take too kindly to the way that I described Camden County and some of the aspects of it. You know, of course, it's just my opinion. At the end of the day, it's a songwriting exercise, you know. Your experience is probably different than mine. But
I want to hear a little bit of the Gloucester County tribute by Keenan.
Curtis Smith is from the Deptford area. Visit them all at the Rowan University, the Common Nurse or Engineer. About 100,000 folks here, all in all.
Oh, beautiful. There's so many things to dissect about this. How would you describe your approach to the humor in the song?
Sure.
There is something specific about it. It's almost like unrefined in a way that's really funny.
Yeah. So I like to think of it as like me being a quote unquote pro trying to do something amateurish.
Yes.
Right. And I think that sort of like contrast and contradiction is like pretty funny.
The song itself is gorgeous. And then it's like some of the lyrics are like, is he making this up as he goes?
Yeah, exactly. I love just like random name drops. And because obviously, you know, you'd be hard pressed to think that this was an actual song on the radio if you just listen to the lyrics. I mean, they're not, a lot of them are disconnected.
Yep.
But I think that's kind of the funny part of it. And it's just like, it's almost like non sequitur after non sequitur after non sequitur. It's like
people who hear your New Jersey stuff will, if they have even a decent ear for music, will understand it's a yacht rock sound.
Sure, yeah.
And before you started this New Jersey project, you were doing all sorts of yacht rock covers with humorous lyrics.
Yeah.
Maybe we can watch the Twitch stream.
How did that start?
I had just seen these trends of like people doing something similar, but it was mostly, you know, popular songs or songs from Hamilton, or and they would replace these words with like what we consider like quote unquote brain rot words of like
brain, you know, rot words.
Yeah, like your skibbity, sigma, riz, all the whatever the kids are saying these days. You
Wait,
know?
You're a kid. You can't say
I guess
that.
So. I guess so. I'm grateful to be in that crossroads.
Right, you're in the middle. You know, So brain rot refers to like Gen Z slash alpha slang, basically.
In a sense, they're related words. You know, brain rot is just like really anything that you would consider not good for your mental health, mm-hmm. you know, online, just scrolling. And part of that is the culture of the young people just coming up with all sorts of newfangled, you know, terminology.
So it's the vocabulary that emerges from spending too much time on the internet. Thus, it is brain rot.
Exactly.
Interesting. So you took big yacht rock hits and then you swapped in these brain rot terms.
Yep.
And that really caught on.
Yeah.
You saw an opportunity because people were not doing this with yacht rock songs.
Exactly.
But did you also like yacht rock?
Or? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, ever since like I was like a teenager and I first like had been listening to like Toto and Steely Dan, something about that music really touched me because it was like insanely high level musicianship, but it was like top 40.
And to be clear, yacht rock predates your parents.
Yes, yes.
So you're discovering this on your own.
Basically, yeah. Just through the power of the internet.
Yeah.
And then everything just kind of unfolded from there, right?
Interesting. So you take these beloved yacht rock songs, you swap in these Gen Z brain rot terms. It obviously has a very humorous effect.
Yeah.
I am curious, like, why it would connect with that audience, given that they, like you, definitely did not grow up with this music.
Yeah. I think the pure just juxtaposition, the pure like contradiction of these like insanely different worlds is enough to be like, what in the world is this?
Right. You almost could do it with doo-wop.
Yeah.
It's just like these terms don't fit in this world.
No.
They collide and there is this natural humor that explodes out of
it. It's just that contrast, that rub, and just exploring that space had been so fun for me, you know, and I still end up doing it every now and again, right?
Yeah. Well, I have to read, and I'm going to read, not sing, the swap that you did on the song Lovely Day by Bill Withers, just to give people a sense.
Sure.
When I open my feed to Marvin Beek and the ghost of goon-slimed guys, the meme depression's PMO, bubonic on my mind. That's the first verse. Couldn't tell you a single one what it means. Do you know what these things mean?
I do.
Okay. Does the audience at this point even understand what they mean?
When I put that out, it was interesting because people had noted that, like, I don't even know what these words mean yet.
Can you just explain when I open feed to Marvin Beek?
Yeah. So just on TikTok, you know, with the rise of AI-generated content, people are starting to create stories and sort of these convoluted universes where there are like characters and whatnot. And if you go on TikTok and you type Marvin Beek, you'll see the same AI-generated character. It's sort of like a James Bond type universe.
But the point is that you have burrowed really deep into these internet subcultures, unearthed these terms.
Maybe it's a, you know, my own character flaw of just like being online too much. But, but it's just fun. It's just fun. Big stuff with an outline we can tell.
That dream's on sight. They got Tommy in it. He would. As we sort of get ready to wrap up, I think the cliche question is like, where do you want to go with this?
Sure.
I think I'm more interested in like, what type of music career do you want to have?
Yeah.
Do you hope this leads to band, tour, management, all that type of stuff? Or do you feel like, hey, long term, I want to be my own independent creator where I get to control everything and interface directly with the audience forever?
Most of me wants it to be like the latter.
Really?
Right? Where I'm not doing this stuff just because like I want attention or numbers or whatever, but I found that like just being a creator, making something and then putting it out and people like it and seeing that it makes people smile and just that cycle of like making something, whatever it is, it may be music, it might be a video, it might be a blog post on some website that I have, whatever it is. But just that that process of creating, I think, is speaking to, you know, who I am. And I think that, you know, I would like to eventually like play shows and, yeah, you know, eventually like put out original music that I am working on right now. But as independent artists start to take over, I guess, yeah, this music industry, a lot of people have been sort of forging paths and letting people in on like, hey, what is it that I was doing? Whether it was like they were running newsletters or like they had merch or, you know, song sales, shows, whatever. That's a model of mine, I would say.
Circling back to where we begin, New Jersey, is there something inherently funny about it?
Yes.
There is.
I think it's you know, pop culture. Yep. Unfortunately, people say it's like the armpit of New York or whatever. Yeah. Or like, and you know, there's that old quote that it's like a beer keg tapped at two ends, right?
You know? I haven't heard that one.
The New York part, the Philly part, right? Yeah. But it's unfortunate that Jersey has to be divided in that way, the New York part and the Philly part, right? Yeah. But it makes sense. And, you know,
but being defined by these things.
Exactly.
That are beyond it, yeah.
And, you know, I do want to show people that, hey, New Jersey is not just like what the site is when you leave New York and you go to see a Giants game at MetLife. You know what I mean? That's not all Jersey is.
Yeah, there is an undercurrent of love
and
affection in there.
Absolutely.
Within the joke.
Yes, absolutely. And I want to show people that, hey, Jersey's great. And I love South Jersey, specifically.
Amen to that. And that was Brain Rot, Yacht Rock, multi-instrumentalist, singer-songwriter, Earth Keenan Salazar. Follow him on Instagram and TikTok at Keenan Salazar for Keenan's quest to produce a song about each of New Jersey's 21 counties. Camden, Gloucester, and Burlington are already out, so just 18 more to go.
Coming up next, Imani Perry talks about her latest book, Black and Blues, How a Color Tells the Story of My People. We'll be right back.
And welcome on back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. What if a single color could capture the essence of a people's history? In her new book, Black and Blues, How a Color Tells the Story of My People, Imani Perry makes the argument that blue does just that. She traces the deep connections between the Black experience and the color blue.
And I know, Cherry, for you, reading this book was kind of like time traveling.
Yeah, I mean, she goes from the indigo trade to the origins of blues music to the blue of police uniforms, traveling in and out of Black history. Before we dug into all of these threads, I asked Imani Perry when she started noticing the connection between Black and blue.
Langston Hughes has this beautiful poem about the blue of Alabama skies, and I remember reading that poem at a very young age and feeling like, oh, that's my home, you know, the sort of the Blackness and the bluesness of the space was so, you know, apparent. And then, you know, once you start following those like little threads, it becomes increasingly sort of obvious that the blues are called the blues for a reason, you know.
Yeah, and at one point, and you write about this in the book, Black people were actually referred to as blue.
Yeah, that was an interesting tidbit that I did not know before I started working on this book, that there were Europeans, people in the UK, who referred to Black people as blue. And I found it as I was researching because I wanted to make the point that we were called by different names, people of African descent, and even the designation Africa is not something that Black people chose. Our language is so bound up with the history of European empires, it's hard to get out of it. And so blue was one of those designations. And Blackness really comes about as a way of describing people of African descent in the midst of the slave trade. And so I was interested. I said, oh, that's interesting that blue was one of those designations. Mm-hmm. But then there's also the process by which Black people sort of took this on and embraced it and created something beautiful out of what was intended to be something degrading. And that I was really interested in capturing. Mm-hmm. You know, that to me is sort of, for me, is the essence of blackness. It's not the fact that we're called this thing, but that we make meaning of it.
I saw you as this time traveler, this person. And in my mind, you're like this caped individual and you got on a blue cape and it's velvet, right?
I love that.
And you're literally flying the reader through time, space. And it's like we're going through two different dimensions and you're honing in on blue.
Thank you. Yes.
And I felt like maybe we can take this ride together and pop in on some of the stories throughout your book. One of the first stories you talk about is Where It All Began. Mm-hmm. And you talk about indigo.
Yeah.
And the indigo trade.
Yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit, because we're going to fly there together.
Yes. Right. I mean, indigo is so interesting because it, you know, it's a gorgeous color. And it captivates the globe. I mean, everybody is yearning for this color. And there's something so human about, you know, wanting beauty. And, you know, in West Africa, people are cultivating indigo as well. And what I wanted to track was this transition from black people cultivating indigo and wearing indigo and this being adorned in this beautiful color to a point where human beings begin to be traded for indigo. That is part of what happens in slavery. And I wanted to take the reader to a place where that is happening. What was that like to see something that perhaps you yourself had cultivated? Somehow you're seen as the same value as this block of dye and you're traded for it. And so something beautiful is turned into a desire that is so great that it would lead to the greatest cruelty. You know, we know what the Middle Passage was like, how horrific, and yet still love blue. And so then I'm thinking, you know, the finding of pleasure and beauty in the condition of being enslaved is something that I also think is really important to talk about. People still wanting to wear blue, painting, you know, their porches blue, the history of Haint blue porches in South Carolina is connected to this, finding spiritual meaning in the color. I think that's also part of what is so kind of mystical and beautiful about embracing blackness in the face of this cruelty and ugliness.
And now I want to sort of fly in time.
Yes. Okay, let's get back on.
I know, we're going to fly and to a time during the Civil War.
Yeah.
And the boys in
the
blue.
Boys in blue.
That blue fabric on the Union soldiers' uniforms.
Yes.
And how it transformed, that meaning of that blue fabric transformed over time. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah. And there's all these references. So I'm like sort of going into archives and seeing all these people talking about the boys in blue coming to the plantation, this sign that slavery is over, but also what it meant for black men to put on this Union blue uniform to free themselves during the Civil War. So that has a powerful meaning, right? The blue as the color of liberation. But those uniforms became, you know, after the war was over, began to be used for police forces. And we know the history of black folks with policing, and it's a long history. You know, we talk about it as though this question just came up in the context of Black Lives Matter. But if you just look at the history of black newspapers, you're talking about 100-plus-year history of people talking about tension with police officers. So there's this transformation from the uniform as a symbol of liberation to the uniform as a symbol of punishment and injustice.
Yeah. And do you think the shifting symbolism of this blue uniform sort of reflects broader changes, though, and the power structure of not just America, but also black people?
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, one of the great tragedies of American history is that the promises of Reconstruction were betrayed. The promise of full access to citizenship, the promise of, you know, of equal protection before the law, the promise of voting rights, they're delayed for generations. And in some ways, you know, that cycle of the promise and the backlash, we've never gotten out of it. And that's part of the story of the book, too, because blue has this quality of being both hopeful and mournful. Of, you know, it's a color that I say is contrapuntal. It it moves both ways. So it works in a sense metaphorically, because we have these seasons of hope and we have these seasons of devastating disappointment. Sort of like the two steps forward, one step back, or the two steps forward, three steps back. Right. That has been the journey of Black Americans. Yeah.
Yeah. And staying in that reconstruction period, the story that also stood out to me was the story of the blue black speller. I had never heard this story.
Oh, yeah.
And this was during Reconstruction when formerly enslaved Black people were learning to read.
Yes. And one of the, you know, it's one of those things that I wish everybody knew, the unbelievable passion for literacy. I mean, Black people filled schoolhouses from every age, from tiny itty bitty children to elders post emancipation. Mm. And the way that most learned to read was with Noah Webster's Blueback Speller. And part of the reason it was so important is that it was a way of learning to read that you could teach yourself
easily.
It's like I have one at home. It's like a thin blue book, you know, on regular paper. But it was seen as this treasure to have this book that you could use to teach yourself to read. And it had little moral lessons in it too. And so if you actually look at the memoirs, the autobiographies of Black folks during that period, Booker T. Washington, you know, the stories of George Washington Carver, that's what they used to learn to read.
And that's one of the stories of hope.
Yeah.
But then a story that also stood out to me, first of all, I laughed out loud and then I gasped and grabbed some imaginary pearls. It was the story of the blue gum Negroes.
I know, it's so great.
I mean, was like, what in the world is this story?
Right.
It had all the elements.
Yes. And this is, it's a tricky one to talk about because it actually is Black folks who are telling this story.
Oh.
Even though it kind of crosses over, this is the story went, is that if you were bitten by a blue gum Negro, a Black person with blue gums, they could kill you. That the bite of the blue gum Negro was poisonous, right? And so this circulated so widely, you know, it crossed racial lines, but it circulated so widely that dental journals were talking about it. So I read articles in late 19th and early 20th century dental journals where they're like, what is this? You know, we have to study the bite of the blue gum Negro, right? I mean, it's wild. And then
it's so crazy.
It's so crazy. And then it makes its way it's in the Atlantic magazine. You find it in newspapers. You find it even in William Faulkner's writing. And I'm fascinated by it because on the one hand, it's like, oh, this is very clearly mythological. And it's in many of these contexts, it's kind of racist. But I also think about it as a kind of power, like this idea, because imagine you think about how close in the South Black and white people were physically. Black people were doing domestic labor. They're driving the carriages and the car. And so if that person could just turn around and bite you,
and kill you.
Right? So it's a kind of like mystical power. People with blue gums were seen as particularly good at hoodoo and the like. And the other piece that I now understand is that it may have happened because human bites are very dangerous. And there's a lot of bacteria in anybody's mouth. So it's possible for someone to have bitten someone and that person to have died, because that could happen today if you're not treated with antibiotics. Yeah. So it's like there's always that little bit of maybe a little factoid in it. But it's funny. And it also speaks to, for me, to this recognition, even in the sort of most vulnerable times, there's this acknowledgement that Black people had power, even if the description was wrong, but that there was some power there.
Yeah. And I tell you, using this vehicle to sort of fly through space and time. So brilliant. Could you read the selection? This one about music. Yes.
What I mean when I say that my people gave a sound to the world's favorite color is this. In the blue above, flight is possible. In the blue over the edge of the ship, one plummets to death. Hell was the bottom of the ocean floor until it became salvation. You had to swing mighty low to bring them up to the blue sky, weightless to memory and suffering. A voice could do it. A chorus could ensure it. In the main and in the meantime of history, Blackness insisted upon standing inside of life with a song. the series of catastrophic encounters on the coast of West Africa, the degradation that took on myriad forms in the Americas, and then the broken promise of freedom and citizenship, well, that was all awful. But conditions being what they were, people kept living with what was at their disposal, like blackberries on the bramble bush.
I just love that selection.
Thank you.
And in the book, you spend some time sort of tracing the journey of blues music from the fields to the juke joints to what we hear now globally.
Yeah.
Sort of what struck you as you were pulling together different pieces of that history?
I think what struck me is that you think about how extraordinary it was to create a musical tradition that impacts the entire world. There's this incredible recorded music and performed music, but the root of this is that this was how people were choosing to live with song, with creating unbelievable beauty. That kind of disposition to living is just so powerful. It's one of the most profoundly human things. I treasure it because it's my tradition, it's our tradition, right? Mm-hmm. But I also recognize that if I step outside, this is something that the world needs to heed about what it means to be a human being.
I just want to say you went so deep as to trace it back to the person named Blue in the fields, who for the first time sang like a work song that sort of told the story and the strife of the people who were working in front of the white oppressor.
Absolutely.
In their face.
Yeah.
And everybody looking like, oh my goodness, who's saying this?
Right.
Is some powerful stuff. Can you please tell that story?
So it's when Alan Lomax, who was a famous collector of folklore and blues music, and has left one of the most important sort of records of the music, and it's at the Library of Congress. But he goes to this plantation and he's asking to hear the Ballad of Stagalee, which is one of these long rhyming folk ballads that provided the foundation for hip hop and the like, right? And this man, Blue, who's in the field with other men working who's been asked to perform this, it says that first he wants to sing his own song. And he sings a song about injustice. Mm. And while the person who's the boss is there, and also Lomax, who was a white man, is there. And it's just a brilliant example, because we also often neglect how much day-to-day resistance and refusal and telling people about themselves took place, even in the context of a sharecropping situation. So it's a beautiful story. And I also, you know, the names, the Blue is a name throughout Black culture and history. Mm-hmm. I love that aspect. And I hadn't ever thought about it explicitly until I began writing this book. And I was like, oh, yeah, there's blues all over the place. Like, people named Blue all over the place. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah.
And I think what would get lost if you tried to separate Black people from the blues?
You just can't. I mean, people do try. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think for me, part of it is you don't have any American music without the blues as a foundation. So people try to separate, you know, we see this with the efforts of the country music industry to try to say that that's not Black music, or, you know, rock music industry to try to say, but it all depends on the blues.
I know this book has been years in the making, but did you come across any moments in your research where you felt like history was sort of speaking to what is happening right now?
Yeah, I have been thinking a great deal about how important it is to actually value what the ancestors have to teach us. I think so we run the risk when we think about how far we've come to think, well, they could not have contemplated our situation. But what we can see now is they absolutely could have contemplated our situation, and they went through things that we are encountering now. And they did enough to ensure that we are here, so we ought to listen to their wisdom as we confront this challenging moment. And one of the ways for me I've sort of found this is the kind of ethical and spiritual and social, in the sense of like being connected to one another, resources that they inculcated. And the biggest part, I think, is to be imaginative and creative, we sort of push those off as just the sort of like kind of extracurriculars to life. Mm-hmm. But actually figuring out how to live in the storm requires a lot of imagination and creativity. Mm-hmm. And we need to turn to that.
Yeah, they were so creative. They survivors and thrivers despite just unimaginable oppression.
Yeah.
And it's a gift. What do you hope people carry from this book?
I hope that what the book allows them to do is to see the world in some refreshed and meaningful ways, so that there's something that ignites for the reader and they walk through the world and they see blue, they encounter blues, and it makes them think about how to tell their own stories. Every time I write a book, I always say it's an invitation. And so I want this book to be an invitation too. I want it to be something that it's an impulse for people to create on their own.
Blue is a color so many of us love. Is that your favorite color?
Oh, yeah. And black.
That was National Book Award winning author Imani Perry speaking about her latest book, Black and Blues, How a Color Tells the Story of My People.
And thank you so much for joining us today on Studio 2. The program is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bestler, and Andreas Copes. Mike Schiffler is our visual producer. Al Banks and Diana Martinez engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory, and Joan Isabella is WHYY's audio general manager.
From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
Ever since the day we met, you know I'm alone.